Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're back to the low-quality sound here. I've been having trouble with my system, but let's go ahead. I hope it's not too much of a trouble to listen over the phone, rather over than the speaker system. All right, today I want to jump into this debate that has emerged over whether the current conditions in the U.S. and global economy are leading to another financial crisis. A debate has recently opened up between Dean Baker, a good economist, and I believe it's the New York Times article here by a fellow by the name of Cohen. Wrote an article in the New York Times indicating similarities between the current conditions here in the U.S., particularly the bond markets, which are larger than the stock markets. I think it's about $40 trillion, total bonds, government bonds, corporate bonds, municipal bonds, so forth, and the stock market, which is at a record high of $30 trillion valuation. And this guy Cohen, William Cohen, has indicated that there's a problem here in the bond markets that may trip into another financial crisis, 2008-09. Well, Dean Baker has taken issue with this, and I can understand why. But Dean's argument is not very clarifying, and I'll explain why I believe that as well, and not very accurate as well. The simple fact that you have a massive debt, whether it's corporate bond debt or whatever debt, is not alone the key. It's not alone sufficient. You have to understand how difficult it may be in a crisis to finance that debt, no, but service that debt, pay that principal and interest on that debt. So the magnitude of debt alone is by itself not necessarily the problem. If there is a sufficient liquidity, income, cash flow, whatever, in order to pay the principal and interest, as long as that cash flow is sufficient, you can keep increasing your debt. But you need to make a distinction between that on the corporate side and on the government side and on the household side. There's three sectors of debt, you see. There's corporate debt, which is usually broken down into financial and non-financial. And there is government debt, which has different levels, state and local government and federal government and special agency debt, like housing agencies. And then there's household debt. And, of course, we know household debt in the U.S. is now at a record, $13-plus trillion in household debt, the four elements being, auto debt over $1 trillion now, student debt $1.4 trillion, credit card debt about $1 trillion, and then about $9 trillion in mortgage debt. So $13 trillion there. We know the government debt is about $21 trillion, the federal government debt. Who knows what the state and local government debt is? You'd have to add it up state by state, but it is significant as well. Okay, but if you look at the $21 trillion federal government debt, a lot of it is debt owed by the government to itself. Excuse me. What does that mean, to itself? Well, the government borrows trillions of dollars, from the Social Security Trust Fund and from the federal pension system. In fact, it's borrowed over $6 trillion over the years because the Social Security and pension systems have run a surplus as a result of hiking of rates, payroll tax rates and so forth, since the mid-1980s. Yes, the Social Security system is, generated over $6 trillion, but the government borrowed every penny of it and puts these treasury bonds in the Social Security Trust Fund in exchange for taking the real money out from your payroll tax hikes. So technically, Social Security is not in debt. It has it's holding bonds of $6 to $7 trillion. Yeah, and it has the right to cash in those bonds. Of course, that would mean that the government would have to put cash where the bonds are in Social Security, and to do that, it would have to raise real taxes to do that. And, of course, it's been on a tax cut binge for corporations and investors for 15, 20 years now, so it's not going to do that. But technically, Social Security is not not bankrupt. It's sitting on a $6 trillion-plus cushion, although it's in bond form. Okay, so it owes the government owes it to itself, and it also owes the same thing goes on with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, where there's debt there that's owed, but it's owed by the government to itself. All right, and then that's about $6 to $7 trillion it owes to itself, and there's about another $6 or $7 trillion that it owes to foreign investors, banks and governments and corporations and so forth that buy U.S. treasuries. So the actual debt that the government has to really service pay is really to the foreigners and to U.S. investors, about $14 trillion, something like that. Okay, that's the federal government debt. And, of course, the income to pay the federal government debt, the principal and interest on the federal government debt, where does that come from? Corporations, the income to pay their principal and interest on their debt, right, comes from their business. If they're non-financial corporations, it comes from, selling their products, their goods and services, and other ways we'll talk about when they can't sell goods and services. But that's the cash flow necessary to service the debt. And you see, it's not just the magnitude of debt that's important. It's the how much cash flow or liquid assets you have to pay your principal and interest. You can keep raising your debt as long as your cash flow rises. But when your cash flow does not rise and your debt does not change, then you're in deep trouble, you see. So it's not the magnitude of debt. You can have a low magnitude of debt but have no cash flow, and then you cannot pay even the low level of debt you may have. Okay, and corporate debt, of course, has risen significantly since 2010 because the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates so low and businesses are just issuing corporate bonds and commercial paper, whatever, because it's so cheap to pay that interest rate. So they've increased their debt significantly on the private side. But their income has been rising through various reasons, squeezing workers and so forth, and, of course, the low interest rates. And now, of course, Trump giving them a 20-30% one-time boost in profitability and therefore cash with the tax cuts. So that's the private side. The government side, where does its cash flow come from? Well, that's from taxes primarily. And if you're given tax cuts, you are reducing your ability to service your debt. But it's the federal government. They can always borrow. And, of course, they're doing that. They're borrowing. That's why we have a $21 trillion debt to service their debt. Households are the third sector, and households have the most difficult problem in servicing their debt. And their debt has been rising. It's $13 trillion, higher than it was before 2007. But they can't raise their income because it's mostly, for most of them, it's wage income, and wages have been stagnating. So households have a difficulty in servicing their debt. and that debt is rising on the household side. Government, federal government, does not have so much difficulty because it can always sell bonds. Or it can raise taxes. The reason it's cutting taxes is because it's so easy to sell debt on the government side. But corporations are the real drivers of this three-sector debt servicing scenario. And as long as their profits are rising, which they have been nicely subsidized by the central bank and now the government under Trump, they can keep servicing that debt and paying the principal and interest, in other words, even as that debt rises. But the big problem will occur when their profits no longer keep rising and they cannot generate the cash flow in order to pay the principal and interest on the huge debt run-up that they have accumulated. Okay, so back to the debate now between Dean Baker and William Cohen. Dean Baker criticizes Cohen, saying that, Cohen is just focusing on debt, on corporate debt. And Baker is saying that he's misleading. Yes, there's $41 trillion in bond market debt in the U.S., $41 trillion. But corporate debt is, not the major component of it. There's only $6 trillion, he says, in corporate bonds outstanding. Well, first of all, that's only corporate bonds. There's many other kinds of corporate debt. There's commercial paper, other kinds of securities, and so forth. So it's not just $6 trillion we're looking at, which isn't a small sum, by the way. It's probably closer to $10 trillion in non-financial corporate debt. Oh, but what about financial corporate debt, Dean? Yeah, the banks and financial institutions hold a big pot of debt as well. So just saying, non-financial corporate debt, bond debt is only $6 trillion, is really obfuscating the true magnitude of corporate debt, financial and non-financial, private business corporate debt. Easily over $10 trillion now. So the bond market, is not so not a problem as Dean would suggest. And he further makes an argument here that is also specious, and that is that the debt service burden for non-financial corporations, the $6 trillion underestimate, is not especially large, he says. Interest payments were only 23.1% of after-tax profits in 2017 for non-financial corporate debt. And that compares to 25% in the late 1990s. So in other words, he's doing this historical analogy, saying, 23%. Which, by the way, isn't a small amount, 23% interest payments on after-tax profits. That seems pretty hefty to me. But he's making it look like it's not that critical, comparing it to 1990s decade of 25%. So in other words, it's not that much worse than it was in the 1990s. Right? Okay. And then he says, besides, these big tax cuts on Trump give a nice big fat pot of cash to corporate non-financial corporations with which to service their debt burden, pay the principal and interest. And, well, he's true in that. I agree with him in that. But I don't agree that 23% of after-tax profits is insignificant. It is significant, especially with interest rates rising and the likelihood of a recession, which would collapse the prices of non-financial corporations and reduce their sales revenue and therefore their profitability. Once that occurs and rates rise and that occurs, well, then that 23% will balloon very quickly. and then you have a problem, you see. Okay, so my criticism thus far of Dean Baker is 23%, given the situation today, is not insignificant. And you're still only talking about non-financial corporate debt of $6 trillion, where actually you should be including other forms of non-financial debt besides corporate bonds, and you should be considering other forms of private financial debt, banks, and other forms of financial institutions. And then you're well over $10 trillion. And if the interest rates are 23% and they're going to 40%, no, now you're in a problem. So the key is what happens when your liquidity as a corporation begins to evaporate. In other words, your cash flow. What happens then? Well, your cash flow declines, but the debt you accumulate does not. You see, the debt remains at the prior levels, but your ability to pay for it, service it, pay the principal and interest, that declines. And now you're in a crunch, right? Now you're in what's called a liquidity crisis. And that's the first stage to a more general, severe insolvency crisis. Liquidity crisis means that, okay, you just don't have your immediate cash flow you had before, but you can go get the equivalent of that cash flow to pay your principal and interest on your debt from other sources. When you can no longer get it from other sources, that means you are in a solvency crisis, not a liquidity crisis. And Dean does not make a distinction between liquidity crises and solvency crises. He's talking about a liquidity crisis here and saying, oh, well, you know, it's not going to be that severe, as well as minimizing the magnitude of the debt by only looking at corporate, non-financial corporate, and non-financial corporate bond debt. He's minimizing it. Okay. And he says, even if there were a problem, you know, of making payments, liquidity crisis, businesses, non-financial corporations, private corporations, would still be able to sell off assets. Well, selling off assets isn't as simple as you think, because it has implications of various kinds, which we'll get to. That's a dangerous condition when a business has to sell off its assets in order to pay the principal and interest on its debt. Because once it starts selling off assets, its stock prices plummet, and it can't raise money. And it gets harder to borrow from banks when banks look at your condition deteriorating because your stock prices is collapsing, right? And what Baker also grossly ignores is says nothing about in his rebuttal to Cohen is what about the contagion effect here across the system? You see, economists don't understand. They know it's there, but they don't understand the channels or the rate of how fast, in other words, contagion can spread from one financial institution to another, and even non-financial to other non-financial and financial institutions, you see. The key to a financial crisis, a big key, is this contagion channels and the contagions, the speed of contagion, right? And how far, the scope and magnitude of contagion. Because in 21st century global capitalism, what we have is this incredible integration and linkage between all these institutions. Incredible. And it's very opaque, because business keeps its secret, does not report necessarily who it has loaned money to, how much it has loaned money to, and what are the terms and conditions on which it has loaned that money. It's a big big blank page, you see, and therein lies the contagion. There's no analyses of contagion, and of course the contagion effects would vary with different institutions and different regions and economies and so forth. So it's a very difficult thing to understand how serious the contagion potential may be. A good example contemporary is Turkey. What's going on with Turkey, the country, and the collapse of its currency, being partly engineered by the Trump administration, wanting to drive it down for political reasons. What are those political reasons? Why is Trump going after Turkey? Well, that's because Turkey is kind of a maverick and no longer, you know, within the U.S. Sphere of control as it once was. And Turkey, for example, is buying surface-to-air missiles from Russia. Oh, that really pissed off Trump and the U.S. defense establishment. You're supposed to buy them from us, right? Well, Turkey's kind of upset because the U.S. tried to engineer a coup against them a year or so ago. And so they don't really trust the U.S., and they're cutting this deal with Russia. Also, they're tied in increasingly with Qatar, whatever you want to call it, right? Economy, and Qatar's kind of going its way independently in the Middle East sheikdoms and leaning towards neutrality towards Iran and Turkey and so forth. And Qatar just recently gave Turkey $15 billion in order to try to mitigate this currency crisis deal. So they're getting closer together. And Iran, you may have an Iran-Turkey-Qatar kind of alliance brewing in the Middle East, which upsets Saudi Arabia. Right? Saudi Arabia is trying to put pressure on Qatar because it hates Iran, et cetera, et cetera. It's a, you know, it's a big mess. It's a big big beehive of political instability over there. You know, so the U.S. is putting pressure on Turkey by trying to drive its currency lower. Even as the U.S. dollar, as it rises, does that naturally, you see. So the Turkish currency has collapsed 40% this year so far. But that appears to be spilling over in all emerging markets, you see, because they're all being negatively impacted by this currency collapse going on because the U.S. is raising rates. And as I said many times, the U.S. is raising, the Federal Reserve raising interest rates in order to pay for Trump's massive trillion-dollar annual budget deficits. So Trump gets upset with Chairman Powell of the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank for what? For funding his deficits? Well, Donald, you can't have massive tax cuts and massive increases in defense spending and equally massive increases in the deficit and debt without funding it some way by selling more bonds. And you sell more bonds by raising the rates, you see. That's what's going on. So it's kind of ironic that Trump is criticizing the Fed. But he won't do much about that. So, you know, to get back to the debate between Baker and Cohen, right? Contagion. Contagion is something he's not even talking about. What are the contagion channels and the sensitivity to contagion, which I call in my work the fragility of the system? You know, fragility, financial fragility is a measure of the degree of contagion potential between financial institutions and non-financial institutions and so forth globally, because it's globally integrated now. All right. A banker says, they can always raise money somehow to pay the principal and interest on their debt, right? He says, it hardly seems like a cause a financial crisis, you know. It may lead to some unhappy investors, but, you know, we don't have a financial crisis. To his credit, Dean Baker was one of the few who said back in 2007-08 that what we got here is a problem in the housing market, the subprime mortgage bond housing market. We have a problem. He predicted that to his credit, but he's kind of myopic about thinking that that's what's going to happen or not happen again. Well, you know, the next crisis is not going to be subprime mortgages. It's not going to be residential property prices. It doesn't happen twice, in the same way. It's going to come somewhere else from another direction. And I've been sort of exploring, you know, what are some of these possible directions that it may come from. Baker downplays the possibility of a liquidity crisis. Once again, he's only looking at corporate bonds, private, non-financial corporate bond markets, not other kind of non-financial corporate debt sources, and doesn't look at financial corporate debt. He's cherry-picking a very narrow element of the whole system here and says, well, you know, it's not going to happen again. And he says if it does happen again, it would be a liquidity crisis because that's all he's talking about. And businesses, non-financial businesses, could respond to continue paying the debt. The debt's not that large, he says, $6 trillion only, right? Which is just a subset, as I say. But the principal and interest can be financed easily enough. Well, how do corporations finance a crisis, right? When they find themselves in the debt crisis, what do corporations do? And that question raises, historical period here in that this is the 10th year anniversary of the 2008 crash. And the Lehman Brothers Investment Bank, which was at the center of that particular crash. Remember Lehman Brothers? This is the 10th year anniversary coming up. It's just about now, in late August, that Lehman was getting into trouble. What kind of trouble? Well, you know, Lehman had invested in a lot of subprime mortgages. Late, it bought up other companies, mortgage companies, late into the price run-up, right, 2007. And they had a lot of subprime mortgages. He was late to the party and bought high. And then when the prices began to collapse, they had losses, Lehman did, on its balance sheets. And because of those losses, speculators jumped in and began dumping Lehman stock, driving down the price of Lehman stock in August of 2008, and causing a solvency crisis as a result of Lehman. Lehman wasn't the beginning of the crisis. In July, the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac went through the same thing. These government agencies holding mortgage bonds, their price, stock prices began to collapse, and the government had to step in and provide a $300 billion rescue fund for Fannie Mae Freddie Mac. But even Fannie Freddie weren't the beginning of this either. If you look earlier in 2008, other investment banks like Bear Stearns underwent the same process, and Bear had to be bailed out by the Federal Reserve and J.P. Morgan Chase. Well, you know, the Bear Stearns did not have to go under, neither did Lehman. Bear Stearns went under because J.P. Morgan stopped loaning them money. These investment banks, you see, aren't regulated. They don't have to keep reserves on hand for emergencies. They lend everything out, and they go after big profits by going after high-risk investments, which at the time was the subprime mortgages. And Bear got overextended up to March 2008, Bear Stearns was being loaned money through the crisis for about a year by J.P. Morgan Chase. And J.P. Morgan decided overnight, oh, we're not going to loan you anymore. Well, that was the beginning of the crisis for Bear Stearns. And Bear Stearns went under, and guess who bought them up? J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan caused the collapse of Bear Stearns and scooped it up afterwards for pennies on the dollar and bought it, the whole thing, for I think something like $29 billion. Entire Bear Stearns, including their $100 billion office building in New York, you know, worth $100 billion. They got the company and the office building for $29 billion. And who loaned them the $29 billion but the Federal Reserve? They got it for free. Well, you know, it began to look like they engineered the collapse of Bear Stearns. But the idea that an investment bank could collapse brought in all the speculators who began playing the collapse of all the other institutions associated with subprime mortgages. I mentioned Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Mm-hmm. Same thing. They drove down the price by speculating, short selling, they call it. And then they turned to other financial institutions in August. They turned to Merrill Lynch, the brokerage. They turned to Washington Mutual, a bank that was heavily involved with subprime mortgages. And they turned to Lehman Brothers. They were driving down the stock prices of all these in August. And then comes September, comes the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Well, Lehman could have gotten a loan from some other institution to continue it, but it was decided the government, in this case the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury, would not assist and engineer a loan to keep Lehman Brothers afloat. Why not? Well, you know, it might have something to do with the fact that the Treasury Secretary at the time, Hank Paulson, former CEO of Goldman Sachs Investment Bank, a competitor to Lehman, did not give his blessing to the bailout of Lehman because Goldman Sachs was going to make a lot of money on what's called derivatives, credit default swaps, that were issued on Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers, by collapsing, Goldman would make money. Now, making money would mean that the big insurance company, AIG, which overwrote credit default swaps on Lehman, would have to pay Goldman Sachs, you see. Investment banks, insurance companies, you know, et cetera, hedge funds, private equity firms, these are all called shadow banks, and they're unregulated, and they engage in high-risk investments like derivatives and mortgages, subprimes, and so forth, because it's big returns for their investors. Big risk, but big returns. So the problem when Lehman collapsed was that Goldman benefited from it, just like J.P. Morgan benefited from Bear Stearns. But the intermediary institution, the party that wrote the credit default swaps on Lehman, was AIG. So AIG then took a big loss. That's when the government stepped in and bailed out AIG to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars so that AIG could make the payments on the credit default swaps on Lehman to Goldman Sachs. Beginning to look kind of, shifty stuff, huh? Well, this is the stuff that bankers do. You just don't see it all the time. Yeah, they're all a bunch of crooks. They're all shady dealings, you know? We see it with Trump and some of his dealings, but they all do that. You know, they're all engaged in that kind of money-making by speculating and shifty and money laundering and all that stuff. Right? So, you know, that is the truth of the collapse in 2008 that was at the center of which was Lehman Brothers. Right? So Dean Banker is wrong that it was really the subprime mortgage mortgage market collapse that was the cause of the general entire credit system collapse in 2008 after Lehman Brothers. Yes, the subprime mortgages were involved in this. They precipitated this with the prices falling for mortgages. But the real cause of the collapse of 2008 was the derivatives markets and the contagion connections between the entire banking system based on the derivative system. What are derivatives? Well, credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, asset-backed securities, et cetera, et cetera. These new financial instruments that are really financial instruments or financial securities based upon other financial securities. That's what we mean by derivative, is derived from. Well, credit default swaps written on Lehman Brothers was a derivative. CDSs, credit default swaps. That was at the center of that crash. And then that crash spread through the rest of the entire credit banking system because of the interconnections of debt owed to debt owed to this to that, right? Throughout all the banks and the shadow banks, right? They're all integrated. They're all connected, you know? And these opaque financial securities that you don't see are really the culprit that connects them, and it's really the source of the accelerated contagion conditions, potential contagion conditions today that exist in the 21st century global capitalist system. That's why when a crisis comes, it spreads pretty quickly across the whole financial system. Okay? So that's a little history of what went on in 2008 at the anniversary of it all, you know, and then when everything started falling, all the pins started falling, Henry Paulson panicked and went to Congress and said, oh, I need $750 billion, you know, to bail out AIG and all the others. Write me a check. That was called TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, $750 billion. Congress kind of choked and then gave it to him. And then he called the banks together, Paulson did, and said, okay, you all got to take some of this money. And J.P. Morgan said, well, we're not in trouble. We don't want the money because when you give us $20 billion, that means you can look over our shoulder and into our books, and you, the government, can tell us if whether we can or can't give ourselves big bonuses, and it's coming up at the end of the year, and we want to give ourselves big bonuses because that's how bankers are paid. You see, it's not salary. It's all bonuses. So J.P. Morgan and, you know, some of the other big commercial banks said, no, we don't want to participate. We don't want the money. And he said, yeah, you take it. I said, no, we don't want it. And here is Henry Paulson sitting on $750 billion. So he calls in the smaller banks, the mid-sized banks, and he says, thou shalt take this money, whether you like it or not, you know, like Third, Fifth, and some of the big medium-sized or regional banks. And, you know, they took a couple hundred billion. And, of course, it took a couple hundred billion to bail out AIG, and some of the money, the $750 billion, went there. And then it took about $100 billion to bail out the auto companies because they were then collapsing. Why? Why were the auto companies collapsing? Because GM had a finance arm called GMAC, and Ford had a finance, so forth. These were shadow banks themselves, right? They were banks. GM made most of its profits in the run-up from speculating in mortgages. Yeah, and then, of course, when the crash came, General Motors finance collapsed and brought down GM. So they had to put $100 billion of the TARP money to rescue GM. And that's where some of the money went. And they sat on the rest, you know, about $300 billion. He didn't know what to do with it. And later on in 2009, they put it back into the Treasury, you see. So that whole TARP thing was really bailing out AIG on behalf of Goldman Sachs and then spreading some of the money around elsewhere So how did the banks really get bailed out? Not until 2009 by the Federal Reserve, the central bank, right? How did the Federal Reserve bail out the banks? It was called quantitative easing, QE. They actually just bought up the bad collapsed assets from the banks and private investors at below market prices, subsidized, just bought it up and put those bad bonds on its own central bank Federal Reserve balance sheet, $4.5 trillion. Yeah, that's what it took. And then zero interest rates for 8 more years. The Federal Reserve bailed out the banks, you know, not the government, not the Treasury, you know, not the TARP, right? Anyway, we've gotten a little far afield on this bailout issue here, but I'm using the history, a 10-year history here, as a means for debating with Dean Baker. My point, fundamental point, contrary to Dean, is, Dean, you can't explain the collapse in 2008 based on simply the housing market. Yes, the housing market played a role. You know, the subprime mortgages helped precipitate it, but it wasn't the fundamental cause of the crisis spreading throughout the whole credit banking system. That was based upon credit default swaps and other derivatives and the contagion, the connections between all of these, and some, you know, shady probable objectives by Goldman Sachs and Henry Paulson and others, as these capitalist bankers gobble each other up, right? Just as J.P. Morgan gobbled up Bear Stearns earlier in the year, Goldman Sachs, through its Treasury Secretary buddy there, Paulson, gobbled up Lehman. And you got made a lot of money on credit default swaps. And then when AIG was holding the credit default swaps, was in trouble, they bailed AIG out, you see. And then they cleaned up the rest and bailed out the rest of the system through the central bank, the Federal Reserve. Right. So Dean does not understand the role of contagion in the financial system. He underestimates it in his debate with Cohen. He underestimates the role of debt. He's only talking about a very small piece, non-financial corporate bond debt, very small piece of the total debt. And he totally ignores the relationship between servicing the debt, i.e. paying the principal and interest on the debt, because that's just as important as the magnitude, the size of the debt. You know, a lot of people just talk about, oh, the debt is too high, the debt is too high, and yes, but it can go higher if you've got the cash flow to pay for it, right? Whether you're corporations or whether you're the government, right? The government's getting in trouble because its means of paying for it, its cash flow, its income, the tax system is reducing its own revenue to pay its principal and interest on the debt. But it's doing this because it knows it can borrow from everybody else around the world, because the dollar is king, you see. If the dollar weren't the world currency, the Federal Reserve and U.S. government could never do what it's doing: finance tax cuts and wars. War spending simply by borrowing, at the same time cutting taxes, you see. That's what's really different about the 21st century, the U.S. in the 21st century. Its money and currency is so powerful, it can do all this globally. First time in our whole history, we financed 18-year wars and defense spending over $1 trillion total every year by cutting taxes. Yeah, we've always raised taxes in wars, but not now. We actually cut them by even more than the increase in defense spending. But we can do this because we finance, you know, we can borrow money from around the world, and we do, right? That's what's different. Okay, so and normally in a liquidity crisis, companies, you know, who face problems with the debt, right, they raise their prices to get more revenue, more income, to pay the principal and interest on the debt. Or they engage in more intense marketing to sell more, right? That's two ways of generating more income, cash flow, in order to pay the principal and interest on the debt. Okay, so when you're in a recession, though, you can't raise prices because the price level and competitors are lowering their prices, and you may engage in more intense marketing, but people aren't buying as much. So that way of raising your cash flow to provide your pay the principal and interest is not available. Okay, so then you can sell more stock if you want. Right, if you're a public corporation, and Dean says, well, you can raise more, sell more stock, right? But when you're in a recession, your stock prices are falling. Who wants to buy? What investors want to buy your stock? so you want to sell more stock when the price of it is falling. So no one's going to buy your stock. That avenue, therefore, of raising liquidity, cash flow, to pay the principal and interest on the huge debt you ran up before the recession, is also cut out. You can issue more bonds and commercial paper and so forth, right? Who wants to buy the bonds in a company, that looks like it's getting more shaky? Investors are going to hoard their money, and they're not going to buy the bonds. And besides, the bond rates are probably going to be too high at the beginning of the recession anyway. People are going to wait for the bond rates to come down, right? So you can't sell more bonds in a crisis, just as you can't sell more stock in a crisis to raise liquidity, cash flow, to pay your debt. Then you can go borrow from other banks, right? Or other capital markets. But in a recession like that, the banks are also turning off the spigot, right? Or they're raising the terms and conditions, making them more onerous for those corporations that want to borrow from the banks. So that becomes a difficult channel. And you can't roll over your old debt. If you have a lot of old debt, short-term debt coming due, and you can't raise money, and rates are too high, et cetera, well, then you can't roll over your old debt, as they say, refinance, roll over. Well, what can you do then? Well, then you're in an even more difficult situation. All you can do is sell off your assets. Well, investors only want to buy your good assets. They don't want to buy your bad assets. And when you sell off your good assets, that further depreciates your stock price. It collapses further, and you're in even more difficult situation to borrow from the banks, selling off good assets. Well, by the way, that's exactly what General Electric's doing today, selling off globally its good assets as it finds itself in trouble. And Citibank is a big thing that Citibank did, and Bank of America did in the last crisis. They had to sell off their assets. Citibank and Bank of America were bankrupt, technically, and the government just kept them afloat. If you sell off your assets, the only last choice you have is to default, which means you cease payments on your principal or interest or both. And if you default, then your price, stock price and everything else, ability to get loans, collapses to the floor. And then the only choice is bankruptcy, where you have court-regulated asset sale-offs. Okay, so that's the process. Once a crisis starts, once a recession starts, corporations have great difficulty servicing their principal and interest on that huge debt run-up that they accumulate during the boom period. And we have this accumulation during the previous boom period here since 2010 up to the present. There's a massive amount of private corporate debt out there. And, Dean, you cannot just look at corporate, non-financial corporate bond debt. That's just a narrow slice of the total non-financial corporate debt out there. Now, they've been able to continue to finance that debt because profits have been rising, and Trump just gives them a 20-30% big windfall here. Yes, they're able to do that. Even though the debt run-up has been huge, $20 trillion of debt run-up since the last crisis in the U.S. alone, even more probably in emerging markets. And, of course, China's debt run-up has been huge. You know, the Bank of International Settlements, you know, you're looking at over $50 trillion probably in debt, additional debt since 2008. The system runs on this debt, you know, because debt gives you big profitability in the short run, but you pay the price in the longer run. And the longer run comes whenever there's another recession. And that's exactly the situation the global economy is in, right? Turkey, emerging markets, massive dollarized debt that they now have to pay with a currency that's collapsing. Therefore, their cash flow liquidity is collapsing to be able to service this huge debt run-up, especially if it's dollarized debt, because interest rates in the U.S. are going up. And, you know, that brings us to the development, another development this past week, which the Federal Reserve, meeting at Jackson Hole, where the central banks get together, has clearly signaled there's more rate hikes coming. Yeah, at least two this year, maybe more next year. That'll go on until there's a true eruption of the crisis in emerging markets, which is showing signs of spilling over from the worst cases now of Turkey, Argentina, and so forth. Is pretty clear now that this currency instability is beginning to hit other emerging markets, India, Indonesia, and, of course, South Africa. And Trump comes out to drive down South Africans' currency even more by talking about the white farmers in South Africa are getting picked on. Well, you know, he's just pandering to racist base here in the U.S. elections. And even Australia now is beginning, the Australian dollar is beginning to decline. And the British pound, less mixed up with Brexit. So, you know, the currency instability, volatility is spreading in emerging markets as interest rates are being raised here. And they're going to be raised even more, right? And then we have the factor of business confidence in this trade war. Now it's pretty clear it's just a trade war possibly between the U.S. and China. And as I predicted last week when I heard the Chinese were sending over a vice trade negotiator, and the U.S. assigns its vice deputy trade negotiator, that was all just window dressing, right? Nothing was going to come of that. And they all know that, right? Of course, this past week, an extra $16 billion was slapped in tariffs on by the U.S. and matched by China. So it's $50 billion now each. And Trump's talking about another $200 billion. I don't believe he'll implement $200 billion more, because if he does, then truly we're in a massive trade war with China that's going to spread everywhere. You see, up to now, it's not really a trade war. We're on the brink of one, though, but only with China. Only with China. You know, the negotiations didn't go anywhere this week, and we'll see where they go next week. Another piece of information interesting was the media, the press, particularly in Europe, hyping the fact that Greece has now been able to extricate itself from its debt deals with the rest of Europe, the Troika, the European Commission, European Central Bank, IMF, that's the Troika, you see. And the Troika imposed $300 billion of debt on Greece. $300 billion. And, okay, so now Greece, the big announcement is, does not have to borrow anymore from the Troika. Oh, so apparently it's recovered? Doesn't have to borrow any more money from these pan-corporate organizations, you know, in Europe. Well, now they can go and they can borrow from the private speculators and bond buyers and so forth, right? So now they're just going to be able to borrow from the private sector. But in the meantime, austerity to pay for all the debt, the principal and interest, continues. And the depression continues. I mean, they're talking about recovery for Greece, but what kind of recovery is it when the unemployment rate is still 20%, when wages have been cut 31 to 35%, depending on skilled and unskilled, when the minimum wage has been reduced by 22%, while pensions have been slashed for retirees and taxes raised on small businesses and workers, right? There's no end to the crisis in Greece. They've just switched bill collectors from the Troika to the private sector once again. Okay, that's Alternative Visions. Next week, hopefully we can get our audio fixed.